This episode of the Hard Men Podcast is brought to you by Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial, by Alpine Gold, by Max D Trailers, by Salt and Strings Butchery, Private Family Banking, Premier Body Armor, and Ecclesia Design. Well, welcome to this episode of the Hard Men Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Kahn, and joined today by the one, the only, bearded, bald Norseman, Dan Burkholder.
Thank you for having me. There is another Dan Burkholder who is actually more famous. He's a photographer.
Really?
Yeah, but he spells his name B-U-R-K.
Is he bald?
I don't know. I haven't seen a picture. It's not self-portrait, so.
You're the only Dan Burkholder that I care about, Dan. Dan, we're going to jump into this episode in just a minute. We're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis and Narnia and some of his views, which are very popular today, on male headship.
Oh, they're popular.
Oh, did I say popular? I meant people hate them. In fact, we'll get into it in just a minute, but I had posted something about C.S. Lewis and headship from, this is from The Silver Chair. So quotes from the book, we'll get into them. But it was interesting because several people in the comments said, I have been a lifelong C.S. Lewis fan and you have forever ruined that for me.
Well, it sounds like you're doing favors.
I mean, if you're a raging feminist, get out. That's all I got to say. You're not allowed to be a C.S. Lewis fan.
No, I mean, you didn't even have to interpret it.
No.
You just read it.
It was basically just reading it. Before we get into that, though, Dan, you had a rousing, and I'm talking rousing, appearance on, well, it's not yet up, but it's going to be on Instagram Reels. It's going to be on Twitter, on X. A rousing, and I mean rousing appeal for people to come to the conference. Is there any way, I know I'm putting you on the spot, is there any way I can get you to
recreate it?
Yeah.
So New Christendom Press is having a conference June 6th through the 8th. Come or don't come. I don't care. But if you are there, I'll see you then or I won't.
But you should come.
Yeah.
That's great. That's
pretty much it.
I mean, spot on. For people who don't know, Dan is our resident Ron Swanson.
A higher compliment has never been given to me.
So. Actually, I think I have given you a higher compliment because I compared you to Puddleglum.
And Samwise Gamgee.
I mean,
I appreciate it.
High country. Nobody ever compares me to characters in, well, actually, that's not true. C.S. Lewis, maybe. Brian has been calling me Reepa Cheap lately.
I mean.
I accept the honor.
Yes.
So we definitely encourage people to sign up for the conference. Dan, this year we have had a massive turnout. Last year we had, I don't know, 150 people who came to our conference. This year we are, I think we looked at numbers today, we're well over 600. I think 650. One of the things I want to encourage people to attend is the concert, which I keep calling a conference, but a concert with Brian Sauvay. We are going to attempt something pretty bold and audacious here. We are going to live record this sucker. We've got a professional sound guy coming. And we hope to have a musical production of sorts, be that an album of Brian's that's produced live. We'll also, Lord willing, have included in that some psalm singing, hymn singing. So be there. Really, I think what I'm saying is if you come and you're part of this live album, then you're basically famous.
Yes.
So you want to be on it. Mm-hmm. So get a ticket for Brian's concert. But the other thing, Dan, we are having, which I think is really cool, is a VIP business mixer. We've got a number of people who are going to be there, including sponsors for this show. We're going to have the guys from Max D who are going to be there. We are going to have Mr. Joe Garrisey. It's going to be a lot of people. And so for people thinking like, should I go to the business mixer? What kind of person should sign up for our VIP business mixer? And give me the
the
pitch on it.
Really, if you're a guy that values networking opportunities, especially for economic benefit and for, you know, relationships with like-minded men that lead businesses and have a lot of responsibilities on their shoulders. I mean, this is a great opportunity. There's really very few opportunities like this that are going to exist in North America to where you have the opportunity to cultivate relationships with men that have similar roles, responsibilities, and are like-minded in building the new Christendom. specifically in their companies and in their corners of the world. So that's why, where I think the greatest benefit is, you know, so if you're a business owner or you're a guy that values networking, that's where I'd go.
Yeah. So, and I think this year, much bigger number of attendance. So there's going to be even better opportunity. Last year, we had a lot of businesses and people connect who were doing, I mean, some of the business deals that came out of this were like in the tens to hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah.
For a lot of people. So I think those connection points are really good. And then also just attending the conference, of course, the VIP mixer is a separate ticket, but attending the conference, we are going to have so many people here. We've got the speakers, obviously. So we've got Pastor Brian, Dr. Joe Rigney, Dr. Stephen Wolf. We've got Joel Webben. We've got J. Chase Davis. There's going to be that. But there's also just a host of people from CJ Engel to Andrew Isker. I mean, guys that we follow on Twitter. This is a great opportunity to connect with what, you know, it can feel like we're a little bit of a small ghetto in the midst of gay globalist multiculturalism in a lot of America. But I think the value of connecting with a lot of those guys and being encouraged.
Yeah, absolutely. There's going to be also just the people that are behind the scenes that are doing the work that are not Twitter famous or podcast famous that you all have the opportunity to be encouraged by and to network with will be great. You know, you'd mentioned Max D earlier and I just had a phone call with them and they even said they've got job openings. And so one of the things that they're hoping to do is at their booth at the conference is to try to recruit good men to do the work to help them build their very, very successful trailer company. And so there's many opportunities there other than just going to a really good conference and listening to really good speakers. I think that's probably the understated but most valuable part of any conference is the opportunity to network with like-minded individuals, especially because of the cultural moment and the temperature right now. And so these guys are like-minded and they think the same things and they eat at the same trough and are made of the same stuff. And so I think that's probably the most valuable aspect of the conference.
Yeah, certainly one of my favorite things at the last conference for us, recently going to Joel Webben's conference, getting to have FaceTime with people.
Yeah,
I think is just tremendous. So definitely encourage you guys to check that out if you have not already bought a ticket. Of course, if you're a Patreon member, there is some special pricing. So sign up today. You can get the link in Patreon for a special discount. Would encourage you guys to meet us June 6th through 8th in Ogden, Utah. Dan, what I want to do now is jump into this episode. I've been thinking for the last 5 minutes of my life about patriarchy, if you can believe that or not. But yeah, a couple things here. So I was preparing for a talk at Right Response Ministries, and I found this talk from Russell Moore from, I think, 2008. And he was talking all about how the Christian world, up until about 5 minutes ago, was all patriarchal and focused on male headship. One of the things that he said was that in this paper was that C.S. Lewis defended headship in Mere Christianity as one of the central tenets of the Christian faith and Christian worldview. So this kind of got me down this C.S. Lewis train of thought, at least on headship. So that's kind of stepping stone number one. Stepping stone number two was my friends were relentlessly mocking me. And my friends were Dan Burkholder, was relentlessly mocking me because, I had not fully read the Chronicles of Narnia. This is like confession time. To be fair, I had probably listened to great portions of it, like in the car where the kids are listening or whatever, and I'm like zoning out. There were points reading through the series where I was like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure I've heard this before, but it was not good.
Mm-hmm.
So this last week, spring break, I started reading through them, right? And was kind of blown away. Life-changing experience.
Wow, really?
It really was.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to you just generally, first of all. We'll get into the headship stuff in just a moment and where I think it shows up. But I think what really changed my life through C.S. Lewis, it's the way he's able to write. He has this saying elsewhere where kind of the point of good fiction is to get past the watchful dragons of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about when you're sitting in a sermon or you're in theology class and you're like, okay, I know what's going on here. But C.S. Lewis gets past all those defenses into your heart in a way that I almost wanted to call it sort of like quote unquote magical Like, he's able to write in such a way where, like, Aslan will scold one of the children and you yourself feel as though you're being scolded. And there were times where Aslan will correct a child, especially like Susan or Edmund, or, you know, in the later novels, you know, Caspian or something like that. He's correcting Lucy about her vanity, I think, in The Dawn Treader, while she looks in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, like I would just start crying because it's like I'm being corrected.
Yeah.
These stories, which are quote unquote child's tales, are incredibly powerful. So that's sort of my, like, you know, 20-second spiel about why it was impactful. But I know that you're a big fiction guy and you're a big C.S. Lewis guy and a big Narnia guy. What is it about these stories that makes them so powerful? Mm. Even especially for adults.
Yeah. The adult part, I think, is really important. C.S. Lewis talks about this in his book, or I don't know what you'd call it. It's not really a book, but like a pamphlet or whatever. It's called an Experiment in Criticism. Mm-hmm. And he actually talks about,
it's like an essay.
It's an essay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. An essay. He talks about being childlike, mm-hmm. and how we need to recapture being childish. And usually when the word childish is used, it's denigrating.
You think about immaturity.
Immaturity. Yeah. 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 Yeah, throwing a hissy fit, whatever, being selfish, like all the things that go with being a child. But he says, he addresses that and he says, we need to capture certain things about being childlike that are actually dulled as you age. One of those things is like boundless curiosity. Mm. Being curious to the bottom. The number of times my kids will ask the question, but why? Why? You know, what's this? What's that? How does that work? Boundless curiosity and wonder at the world that God created. And there are many, many things that he talks about. I haven't read it in years. So if I had been more familiar, I could give you more. But the idea that C.S. Lewis values childishness so highly comes out in the books in one way in particular that I can't remember where I heard it from, but you have a lot of these children's stories, and the way that they make the children the protagonists is by making the adults dumb. They have to make the adults seem like big dopes in order for the children to actually be the heroes.
They're the heroes. Yeah.
You know, and in Narnia, that's actually not the case. He elevates children by making them believable and by helping you to recapture some of the best virtues of being a child. And so I think that's why it's so powerfully relative for adults, is because there's something smoldering in every one of us that is rekindled when we read those stories, because you can see yourself as these children. And they don't have to, he doesn't amplify some of the boneheaded immaturities of children to make it to be distracting from the story. There are some of those things, but they're all very relatable. Mm. And I think that's really helpful. So in recapturing that childlike wonder for the world and for creation, also through his world building and the things that he emphasizes about Narnia, it was like, I think Tolkien, somebody said, like, you can smell the earth of Middle Earth. Like, you can smell it. It's very real. With Narnia, there's something in one's heart that just longs to be there. I want to be there. Well, Middle Earth is familiar. I don't mean to like compare them as like, but I think there is something helpful there. Middle Earth is relatable, and there is wonder there, and there's magic, but it's very cold and it's brutal and it's beautiful. But there's something about Narnia that is like, this is like a dream-like place that I would just long to be.
But it somehow works. And this is what I mean. It somehow works on the affections of your heart. So I found myself, like, you know, I was talking to my wife about it and she was like, I seem like really moved by this story. This might've been after Caspian. Mm-hmm. She said, what are you thinking? And I just, like, what came out in the moment, I was like, I want to touch Aslan's mane.
Yeah.
Like, I want to have one of these conversations. And really, you know, you have Aslan, who's the picture of the Lion of the Tribe of Judah and all that. I get that. Like, this Christic figure, all that. Mm-hmm. But Lewis is able to, he's able to tell the story in such a way where, like, you want to be in Narnia. You want to, in, you know, Michael Ward in his book, this is Planet Narnia. He talks about, he's going through like how the books of Narnia are a reflection of the seven planetary systems in the medieval mind. But as he's going through that, he said, what Lewis is trying to do is he's trying to transport you into an environment, not where you contemplate it, but where you enjoy it.
Interesting.
And so as you're going through that, you're thinking, yeah, there's something weird happening. I don't even understand how it's working on my emotions, but it is definitely impacting me. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the major themes that Michael Ward talks about is central in all of Lewis's medieval mind was Jupiter. And Jupiter is the planet of joviality and kingship. And this is why The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is really the jovial book, is filled with mirth and winter turning into spring. This is what good kings do. And there's this interesting line that Michael Ward says. I think he's quoting an early Lewis essay, but he said, our world is fundamentally Saturn. And Saturn is the planet of sadness and grief and death. He said, it's the only framework which people know. And the thing that needs to be reintroduced is the jovial king. Mm. Because it's like our world, you know, he fought in World War I. Think about the time period he was living in. And he said, nobody knows anything of joviality and kingship and gladness and royalty. So that definitely comes across in the books, and I think makes it something that you definitely want to be a part of. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because one of the quotes that I was looking at on headship, which comes from Lewis, this one is, I have to think about, I'm not sure the exact source. I think this was an essay that he actually wrote about women ministers, whether or not they should be permitted to be ministers in the Anglican Church.
Okay.
And he said, absolutely not. But this is one of the quotes. He said, I do not believe God created an egalitarian world. I believe the authority of parent over child, husband over wife, learned over simple, to have been as much a part of the original plan as the authority of man over beast. I believe that if we had not fallen, patriarchal monarchy would be the sole lawful form of government. And that's the end of the quote, by the way. But you read that and you're like, I think the average person in America, you know, we're imbibed in like liberal secular democracy, quote unquote, this democratic system. And yet when you read Narnia, Lewis is undoubtedly a royalist, a monarchist. It's the king. And I think he's actually right here, by the way, about patriarchal monarchy mm-hmm. being the ideal. When you get to heaven, Lewis was, you know, he would say something like this. When you get to heaven, there's not going to be a democracy. There's going to be kingship and mm-hmm. you're going to rejoice in it. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Yeah. As you've been talking, I've been thinking about The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe. And mm-hmm. and that's been one of the books where I'm like, eh, it's fine. It's fine. But there are some really interesting themes there that I hadn't really considered as deeply profound. But when you're talking about monarchy and Lewis's view of the world, you do see the thawing of the deep winter without Christmas, mm-hmm. which funny
where there
enough,
is no king.
There's no king. And as soon as the kings, you know, are coming closer to Cair Paravel, all of a sudden the snow starts to melt and the flowers start to bloom and there's joy and
the golden
feasting,
age of Narnia comes
and the golden age of Narnia comes. Yeah, exactly. But that picture of like, as the king arrives, things get better until there's a time of peace. And that's a really interesting theme. And so you can see in Lewis's mind, what would change the world? Well, it seems like a righteous king would definitely change the world yeah. in his mind. Yeah. But instead, what we have is winter without Christmas.
I.e. democracy.
Mm. Yes.
I rest my case.
Egalitarian democracy.
As the saying goes, gold is the money of kings, silver is the money of gentlemen, but debt is the money of slaves. If you're tired of seeing your wealth sapped by the silent theft of inflation, consider adding gold to your financial plan. Gold and silver have been recognized as sound money and a store of wealth for centuries. Converting your savings into gold and silver will protect and preserve your wealth so that one day you'll be able to pass down a true inheritance to your children's children. That's where our friends at Alpine Gold Exchange come in, offering 0% buy-sell spread, gold leases with up to 3.5% annual return, paid in gold, by the way, and secure vaulting right here in Utah. Alpine Gold approaches every transaction with fairness, honesty, and respect, reflecting a strong Christian business ethic in all that they do. Head to ogden.gold today or tap the link in the description to sign up or schedule an appointment to speak with an Alpine Gold advisor today and see what would best serve your family. And just so you know, if you schedule a call, you'll be speaking with Jace, Ethan, or Stu, three members of Refuge Church right here in Ogden. Head to ogden.gold and check it out today.
Here at the Hard Men Podcast, I've spoken with some very successful and competent men. Most of these men share a characteristic of delegating to other competent men to manage various aspects of their lives or businesses. I've realized that I don't have the time to properly navigate investment portfolios, financial planning, and tax strategies. It simply takes away from the most important work that I do. That's why I've used Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial to help me with integrated planning. Joe is a Christian man who focuses on insurance, investments, tax-efficient strategies, company benefits, debt plans, estate planning, multi-generational planning, and more. He's been available when I have questions or ideas for my financial planning and future, and Joe has made a plan specifically for my family and my goals that best suit my needs. Whether you have millions in assets or just starting to invest, Joe Garrisey can help you reach your goals to grow the kingdom and leave a good legacy for your generations. You can visit backwardsplanningfinancial.nm.com. Again, that's backwardsplanningfinancial.nm.com or call 615-767-2555 to speak with Joe to prepare for your future. The testimonials presented may not be representative of the experience of other clients and are not a guarantee of future performance or success. America is built on the backs of hardworking blue-collar Americans. That's why we're so excited to join forces with MaxD Trailers, a Texas-based and family-owned company, to bring you this episode. We're proud to partner with MaxD to see the vision of New Christendom established, one small business at a time. MaxD builds innovative, hardworking trailers for the builders, fixers, and growers of the world. You can follow their stories by checking out MaxD Trailers on Instagram or by visiting the link in the show notes. Learn more about MaxD Trailers by visiting maxdtrailers.com, where you can check out the article, 10 Ways to Make Money with Your Trailer. It's a dangerous world out there, and one of the main duties for men is protecting themselves and their families from all the crazy that the world might throw at you. Here at the Hard Man Podcast, I rely on Premier Body Armor to keep me safe. And trust me, when you say unpopular things like I do, you definitely want the best in body armor. My go-to everyday armor of choice is Premier Body Armor's Everyday Armor T-Shirt 2.0 Bundle. It's discreet, comfortable, and highly breathable. It features two level 3A soft ballistic inserts, one for the front, one for the back. And the bundle comes with white and black shirts that are moisture wicking and can be worn under a dress short or a polo for more casual days. It's an incredibly practical solution for your EDC needs, and the total kit with both plates weighs under 2 pounds. Order your Everyday Armor T-Shirt 2.0 from Premier Body Armor today by visiting the link in the show notes. You know, democracy is very egalitarian. Like, you look at our society and they're like, well, every man, woman, and child and immigrant and everyone else should have equal vote. And, you know, my question would be, what does it produce? And I think what Lewis shows you, he doesn't give you an argument, but the narrative is the argument. And what you find yourself longing for is wise kings and good kings and the glory of a king's reign. So that's, I think, really helpful. I do want to jump into what I wrote on Twitter about headship. And this comes from, as I said before, the silver chair. This is at the end. But this is what I wrote. I said, C.S. Lewis rightly recognized that women, by their nature, were not made for fighting battles or for being in roles of headship. That's why Susan and Lucy weren't allowed to fight at the front lines. You remember Father Christmas Comes. This was, by the way, Tolkien was so upset with Lewis that he included Father Christmas.
He
included like, what Santa is this Claus. Hodgepodge of?
Well, it's funny because before I had kids, Brian and I were talking about The Lion and the Witch Wardrobe. And I said, I just don't like Santa Claus. And Brian's like, are you kidding me? Santa's like one of the best parts. Now that I have kids and I read it again, I'm like tearing up because Father Christmas is there.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's great.
It's great. So Father Christmas comes, he gets them all gifts. Peter gets a sword Edmund, I think it's a sword too. I think they get sword and shield. Of course, Peter's sword is better.
Well, and Edmund had betrayed them, so he wasn't there.
Edmund's not there at that point. Yeah. He gets his later. That's right. So Peter gets his sword. He's going to be the High King. Lucy gets a little healing potion thing and then a dagger. And then Susan gets
the bow.
And the girls are like, but we want to fight. And Aslan says this, quote, "Battles are ugly when women fight." And C.S. Lewis was right. So I go on. At the end of the Silver Chair, Lewis has the head. And it's interesting. He keeps capitalizing head. H-E-A-D, head. He's talking about headmaster of a school.
Yeah.
But it's the way he does it.
It also ties into that hideous strength, by the way. Yes,
which we'll get into. So he says, at the end of the Silver Chair, Lewis has the head of Eustace and Jill's school portrayed by a woman. As the school bullies find Aslan and Caspian returning Jill and Eustace to their world, they cry out, "Murder! Fascists! Lions! It isn't fair!" This is precisely the sort of thing a woman pretending to be a head would be duped by. Rather than responding in a just fashion, that is, righteous justice, she is easily played by the empathy card of the bullies who say, "It isn't fair." Lewis writes of this supposed head, quote, and this is the end of the Silver Chair. "She had hysterics and went back to the house and began ringing up the police with stories about a lion escaped from the circus and escaped convicts who broke down walls and carried drawn swords. When the police arrived and found no lion, no broken wall, and no convicts, and the head behaving like a lunatic, there was an inquiry into the whole thing. After that, the head's friend saw that the head was no use as a head. So they got her made into an inspector to interfere with other heads. And when they found she wasn't much good, even at that, they got her into Parliament, where she lived happily ever after." End quote. And this is my final comment on it that I wrote on Twitter. An organization or society run by women pretending to be heads is going to operate on the impulse of empathy, not justice, and will therefore devolve into just this sort of lunacy. So, Dan, I want to ask you a bunch about this, because there's a lot in here. But one of the things that's interesting in Michael Ward's planetary evaluation, the Silver Chair is the moon. And the moon, of course, in medieval thought is lunacy. Or, mm-hmm. You know, it's tied to going mad. Now, I find this so fascinating. We think words like lunatic, luna, L-U-N-A, you know, for moon.
Yep.
So that's interesting. But even Eugene Peterson in the psalm, I have to look this up. "The Lord is my keeper. You know, he keeps me from the sun by day and the moon by night." The word for the moon by night there is actually a reference to being moonstruck, which was an ancient way of talking about going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So the moon is associated with craziness. Of course, Lewis here is talking about, he uses the word lunatic.
It's also a theme in Lonesome Dove, by the way, which you've talked about on this episode.
Yeah.
Or on this season.
Which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, the connection with this book and the moon. Of course, the children are underground in this world of madness and a maddening enchantment from the, I don't know, venom snake witch in the underworld. But that's a good picture of madness. You can't see the sun, so you go mad.
Yeah.
So the darkness, all those themes are here. But I think it's interesting the way that Lewis describes a woman trying to be a head. And so I want to get your take on that. Why do you think he wrote this very comical, headmistress, but he calls her a head?
Yeah.
And then he talks about how basically terrible she was as a head.
Well, right. In the story early on, if you recall, at the beginning of the book, Jill and Eustace are at this school and it's horrible.
Yep.
And it's an absolutely horrible place.
And Lewis says in the beginning, too, he's like, it was horrible. And by the way, it was run by a woman.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you know what's really funny about that is that it was mixed, right? It was boys and girls together.
Lewis did not like that.
He didn't like that. And honestly, we're not the biggest fans either. But I digress. So you have this essentially horrible atmosphere that's not being managed well. Lewis mentions empathy, or you mentioned empathy. But the first thing that I think is really funny is where he responds, you know, she responds to the lion and to Jill and Eustace coming back and Caspian. And it says that she had hysterics.
Yes.
She had hysterics, which, I mean, it would make sense for an emotional creature to be hysterical when there is a large lion and men with drawn swords on your schoolyard. But one of the things that you'll notice, how much trouble do we want to get in this?
A lot.
Okay.
So the main reason I brought you on is because the last time that we really had trouble, it was because of Dan.
But you got blamed for it. That's
the thing. And Allie Beth Stuckey. But I got in trouble and I'm here for it.
Yeah.
Can I inject one thing?
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of the Don Treader is that you get a good look at Reepa Cheep, which was like, I felt like my avatar. It was just my soul animal, if you will. There's this part at the end when they're sailing towards the sun and the waters are clear and they see the people underneath and like the basically mermaid people, whatever, the king comes up with his trident and he's shaking at them like he wants war. So Reepa Cheep jumps in because he thinks he's been challenged to fight.
Yeah.
And he jumps in the water and is like, up, let's go to war.
Let's go.
And they have to grab him. They're like, Reepa Cheep, my guy. One other Reepa Cheep story. I said only one interjection, but they're on the beach. Eustace has turned into a dragon. This is Don Treader. Yeah, that's right. They're on the beach. He's turned into a dragon and they think they're going to have to fight. They don't know it's Eustace. They think they're going to have to fight the dragon. And Caspian's, he's like trying to figure out what to do, right? And Reepa Cheep says, Your Majesty, if I might. And he immediately snaps back. He's like, no, Reepa Cheep, you may not challenge the dragon to single combat. I know what you're going to ask. And I was like, Reepa Cheep is my guy.
Yeah.
So back now.
Well, no, I think that's a really good picture because, Lewis really, really does this throughout the story with Caspian and even being having to be reminded of his duties as a king, why he can't go into the Eastlands. Is that right? Eastlands. Yeah. And with, Reepa Cheep and his quest for honor and to be valiant in battle and to be loyal to the king and to his people. There are themes like that for masculinity. And then he also has positive femininity, but
I want to interject one thing because I find this so funny. The word lunatic, which Lewis uses, is very interesting. Well chosen. But so is the word, as you mentioned, hysterics. When you said the word out loud, I thought of something. Have you ever heard the word hysterectomy?
Yes.
So the Latin root, well, actually, it's from the Greek hystera, which means womb, uterus, or hysteria. As we would think about it, of going mad. I think Lewis knew what he was doing. Like when you put a woman in the head. See, the thing is, when we think about our wives, when they're in their proper God-ordained role as mother and keeper of the home, they're not hysterical.
No.
But when you try to put her in a head role, you need to make decisions for the family. You need to be the breadwinner for the family. You need to go to college and have a career so that you can lead your family. When you put her who has a womb in that condition, that's when you see hysterical women. I think it's interesting that Lewis ties that together.
Really? Tell me more.
Tell me more. That's what I got. That's what I got on that one.
Well, so, no, yeah. I think
keep interrupting.
No, we all experience this though. We have experienced this. If you've worked in any W-2 job anywhere and had a female boss, you can relate to this. There's a reason that a matriarchal type of tyrannical mother-in-law or even mother has a sort of reputation, that they have. If you, you know, the hysterics takes on a different, more of the, snake-like, you know, queen lady, where if you misstep or say the wrong thing, you will have your head bitten off. The emotions of a woman under pressure in a role that she's not meant to operate in, will result in an emotional outburst and hysterics. It's the same thing though. If a man is subjugated in a role that he's not meant to be in, will cause him to be effeminate. And so I think back to our monarchy and our democracy conversation, you have men that essentially are on the same plane in an egalitarian plane as women that are ruled by women many times. What is that? What is the fruit that you should expect? Well, it's not kingly men that will fight for their king and country, but they will be effeminate because they're led by hysterics.
That's insane. So this is interesting. I looked this up in a couple places, and when you look at, again, the root words, hystera, which means womb or uterus, why was it the root word for hysteria or craziness? It's funny because you read the entries on this and they're like, well, because the Greeks were really dumb, blah, blah, blah. And this is what it said. Historically, it was believed that hysteria, particularly in women, was caused by disturbances and radical emotions associated with the uterus in a woman's time of month. They're writing this like how dumb they were. Okay. The Greeks' belief led to the use of the term hysteria to describe a state of uncontrolled emotion or behavior, which is most commonly found in women during certain parts of their menstrual cycle. Every man on earth and every woman on earth who's honest with herself knows that that is true. Right?
Yeah.
This conversation always comes up in leadership with like U.S. politics, because I remember in my lifetime early on, it's like, would you want a woman who menstruates pushing the nuclear button? And like everybody was like, yeah, that's probably a bad idea. Now we pretend like that's not reality.
Yeah, that's not something you can notice. Right.
But there is a difference in the sexes. This is why the woman will do so poorly in a leadership role, is because she's got those emotional responses. And when you look at them from a mothering perspective, it actually makes sense, because the uterus is for what?
Making children. Growing children. Yeah.
That's right. And when a woman has to fight, as Lewis said, things get ugly, because if she's fighting, it means she's defending herself or more likely her children. Mm-hmm. She's going to go full mama bear.
Yes.
And rip she has
faces
to.
Off. Yes. Yeah. And absolutely. And that's not to denigrate women. It's that the glory of women are not to be bad men, right? They're not meant to be men. Like, they're just smaller framed and weaker versions of men.
Well, and this is the interesting thing with Lewis, because when you look at The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Lucy and Susan have this great relationship with Aslan. I mean, a favored role, I would even say, in many ways. They're the ones who go with him to the stone table. They're the ones who have these long, deep conversations with him. It reminds you of the women at Jesus's tomb. They are not denigrated as people, but Lewis doesn't do the modern, really retarded modern thing where he says, therefore they should rule.
Yeah. Or Susan ends up winning the battle. She comes as like the deus ex machina, you know, and wins the battle.
No. And even in, say like in Caspian, Susan's in that one, but she's painted mostly as, you know, their journey to go find Caspian at the How. She's painted mostly in a negative light, particularly because she's growing up and her number one sin in that book is nagging. And Lewis is not merciful with her on that front, nor is Aslan. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. Like, he understood the dynamics of sexual nature.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but the context in which the motivation that Lewis wrote these books was for his, I would think it was niece and nephew.
Yeah.
And so if you take yourself away from our current culture and the environment and everything like that, what's politically correct and all of that, if you were to write a book for your children or for your niece and nephew, and you wanted to highlight certain temptations for the particular ways in which both boys and girls and men and women will be tempted to sin, those are the sorts of things that that Lewis writes. And so it's going to be hysterics. It's going to be nagging. It's going to be vanity, you know, all of these feminine sins. But the same thing can be seen as men. Cowardice, betrayal, a lack of honor, shrinking back, you know, all of these things are greed. Those sorts of themes are prevalent in the male characters as well. And so I just think it's a really good barometer as to the reading something that was written before our current time. This is why it's so important to read old books. I know it's not that old. You know, it's only what, 70 years old at this point.
Yeah.
But it's a lot's changed.
It's pre-sexual revolution.
Yes.
And obviously Lewis wrote essays on this. So they were dealing with the early phases of like, you know, should women be priests and stuff like that. But it's interesting because most of the comments on here are like, I've read Lewis all my life on Twitter in response to me. I've read Lewis all my life. Unfortunately, he was a total misogynist and you just have to reject that part of him, blah, blah, blah. And but the thing is, this is the chronological snobbery, but it's like, or maybe he was right. Like, does anybody ever stop and ask that question? Dan, one of the things that I think is really interesting, let's go back to the school bullies for a minute. The school bullies, they find Aslan and Caspian returning Jill and Eustace, and they just start crying out like the woke mobs today. Murder, fascist, racist, you know, bigot. And I love, he puts at the end, he says, it isn't fair. So there's a misplaced call for some sort of justice. But it's interesting to me that women are particularly prone to this sort of manipulation.
Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. I think that women are, again, very emotionally driven. They're by nature nurturers. Men are much better at drawing hard lines, defending the perimeter. I think that women, this is kind of what Joe Rigney talks about with the sins of empathy. Wherever you have like a, the amount of female heads goes up, like women leading in a society, church, or family, the more that happens, the more the empathy card will rule the day, which it just means like crazy emotions are going to run the show. And the thing is, if the ticket to leadership is being crazy emotionally, women will always have the advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing is, any honest woman will tell you this. She knows how to control a home with her emotions. Now, in a good home, she can be a great help and support and life giver to her husband and her children through things like, I'm always blown away by this. A woman who smiles at her children and her husband, it's like intoxicating. Just smile at your people.
Yeah.
And speak sweetly to them. It's amazing what you can do. On the other hand, a woman who's near her cycle or a woman who's upset about what's going on, she is going to throw an absolute fit and people will go into hiding in that home. Well, think about it. It's like you go into a workplace. How many female bosses have you had where you're just like, or men acting like women, where you just go, this is a passive aggressive, nasty, emotional, hysterical environment.
Yeah, that's definitely the place where I have the CYA folder so that I, you know, cover your assets.
Yes.
Folder so that you, because it, eventually it's going to explode at some point.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to capture all of the passive aggressive notes and emails and emotional outbursts and things like that. So I can relate,
but
not here, but
yeah, but it's interesting too, Dan, you think about this, like, think about how it can be weaponized in a feminine society, in a female dominated society like our own. Murder, fascist, lions, it isn't fair. Think about today what's going on with Christian nationalism. All you got to do is call somebody a fascist or a Nazi or a racist, or the word now is kinist. All you got to do is that, and it's all of a sudden like, I can't even have a conversation with you because you're subhuman. Why? Because somebody called me a name or called this other person a name, or you referenced the Jews or something like that. So now you're off limits. But this is the sort of manipulation that will tend to happen. And again, I think it's particularly tied to the female bearing gone wrong when it's put in a place of headship. I think that's typically where you're going to see this sort of thing. I also think it's interesting. I want to see if you think this is true. I always found working in a corporate bureaucracy to be particularly, it's a particularly feminine environment in the sense, like everything that's bad about, you know, what we're talking about, the hysterics, all that stuff. It's like everything goes wrong when you put women all throughout that workplace and then in charge of the positions in the workplace. I always found it to be a very passive aggressive, nasty environment. I did not enjoy corporate America because men didn't act like men. They acted like gossipy, catty, nasty, like the worst kind of women.
Well, and I think it's amplified or caused in part because of the dreaded human resources department. Well,
that is the epitome of what I'm talking about.
Well, you have essentially an organization or a department that is a gatekeeper for the entire business.
It's basically
corporate entity. So they're the ones looking at resumes. They're the ones doing the you know, so gatekeeping in. And then once people are in, where are you supposed to go with issues? You're supposed to go to the catty ladies in HR.
Well, think about this. I'm thinking of like five or six companies I've worked for.
Who, by the way, are notorious gossips. So, right. Lack of confidentiality.
But I'm talking like in most of the cases that I've dealt with HR departments, it's either like an old woman or a gay dude. And you're like, what do those people act like? You know, and they were usually like, it was weird because it would be like somebody who was like on the surface, like sweetie, like the overly Southern sweetie type thing or whatever. But then like maliciously ripping your heart out or something like, oh, by the way, like we're just going to have security escort you out with the folder. And I'm like, you think I want any of the garbage from this building? This was an instance when I actually took another job and they were negotiating back and forth. And the minute I said, no, thank you for the offer, but I am going to accept this other offer. Okay, great. Well, security will be right up. And I was like, 2 weeks? You're not going to give me... No, we don't want you to steal any more intellectual property. And I was just like, this is the slimiest, like, you can't even have, like, man-to-man type conversations.
Yeah.
You can't even be treated like an adult. Tucker Carlson said this recently about HR. You know, he was talking about how just vile it is, and it's tied to the... How did the DEI stuff get into corporations? Through the HR department.
Mm-hmm.
All the racial, you know, all that stuff. It's through HR. But it's like, he said, I couldn't even go to an employee and be like, hey, do you have a problem with me? No. You got to go through HR. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a process.
You have to gossip.
You have to gossip. They're encouraging gossip.
Yeah. What's interesting is, so my wife, back when we were right before we got married and right afterwards, she was working for this large Fortune 500 recruiting company. So they hired everyone from doctors and C-suite kind of guys to like hospital staff and, you know, telemarketing people. So everybody, right? And so she worked with a lot of these HR recruiters, you know, for different companies. And what's really interesting, so this was 10 years plus ago. She said she had talked with one of her former coworkers, and just to get a temperature of what's going on there. And she got off the phone and she told me, like, I am so glad that I got out of there, because I would have had to have been fired. There's no way I could have done this because of all of the different DEI stuff. That's all the gay and woke stuff that's getting jammed down everybody's throat. And she said, there's no way I would have been able to keep my job there without getting fired. And so it is really interesting that with the gatekeeping, that those are the people that they're also attracting. Is that there's the mandatory hiring of sexually confused people, of different races, and of different religious backgrounds, in all for the sake of multiculturalism. And so your corporations, the people that are being financially benefited, are the people that are actually destroying the moral fabric of the United States. And so, I don't know, take that for what it's worth. Those are the people, by the way, that have jobs and that vote.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting, too. And then, like, this has been a hard one for a lot of people. I think, you know, people who listen to this, but, you know, feedback from Right Response Conference, I spoke on patriarchy. It was good, but it is hard because people were like, I appreciate you're talking on patriarchy, but it's been hard for me to digest. I've never heard a sermon on that or a sermon on... You know, women shouldn't be ruling in society. That it's foreign. It's the first time that, you know, they're hearing.
It's in the Bible.
But that sort of thing. Yeah, completely. guys like C.S. Lewis, up until pre-1960 especially, this was just common fare. Mm-hmm. If you read any of the Puritans, if one of the publishers hasn't, you know, excised the good portions from them, you'll find that that's all in there. But what's interesting to me, Dan, is here's what happens when I start talking about these things. I gave my patriarchy talk, which you can find on YouTube, which should probably link to it, at Right Response. But I had some pastor friends that I went to seminary with. And they were like, this is the good thing about guys who preach expositionally, by the way. They listened to it and they were like, you know, I was listening to it and I was having a hard time. But then I started looking at the passages and I'm like, I think he might be onto something here.
Like you invented it.
Right. But they're, this is what I love. They're good Bereans and they're going to go read the text,
right?
Which is what I want people to do. Don't take my word for it. Go, you know, read Zach Garris, Masculine Christianity. He'll show you. So that's really helpful. But it was really interesting because one of my pastor friends said to me, he goes, you know, I'm listening to you talk about this. And like, I think you're right. Like if women are made to be in the home, that's her. She's the oikos despot, is what Paul calls her. She's to serve in the home. She's not to be outward facing in the civil magistrate sphere. She's not to be even historically. She that's why she wasn't voting. It was actually a protection to women.
Mm-hmm.
You focus on the home. I'll take care of this, babe.
Like, and we curse to society if she rules.
Yeah, yeah. Curse to society. We find that all throughout the scriptures. But he said to me, he goes, if all that's true, I'm not sure women should vote. So here's where the rubber, I think, hits the road for people is you go, but wait a minute. That's crazy, isn't it? Because we've been raised on a steady diet. You can drive through Salt Lake and you find all these signs like Mormons were some of the first to have women voting in the, you know, the 19th Amendment. Isn't that like we grew up with, like, that's a birthright.
Yeah. In my city council, I think there's 8 seats and only 2 are men.
Really?
Yeah.
That's disturbing.
Yep.
So I guess, you know, as people start making the connection points, there's a potential that they go, wow, you guys are really weird. But historically, would this have been seen as weird that women are voting?
Yes, absolutely. It would be weird.
We would be the oddballs.
But the thing is that with our feminist mind, our feminist hive mind, they would say, well, yeah, that's because this is the first time in history that women have not been repressed.
Correct.
They've not been subjugated because of birth control and abortion rights, sexual rights, reproductive rights. So they could actually escape the bondages of the home, essentially transcending their created purpose to a higher plane, which is very transhumanist and absolute garbage. Right. But sexual revolution aside, all of that. What does the scripture say about women? You just mentioned some things, you know, that women are a curse. They're oikos despot, and that also they're more easily deceived. I think that's something that people try to explain away.
Do you think that if that's true, is a woman in the workplace more easily deceived?
Oh, yes, she's a woman.
What about a woman in politics?
Yes.
Because what you're saying is in her nature.
In her, yes, because.
So she takes that nature everywhere she goes.
Paul roots it in created order by saying it was Eve that was deceived. Eve was the one that was deceived. The first woman, she was the one that was deceived, right? Not Adam, not the man. And so ruling, politics, head of school board, schoolmaster, you know, or headmaster, all the way down to the woman that has the right to vote, which, again, democracy, we're not the biggest fans. But women that can vote, all you have to do is just pull up the statistics over the last few elections and just arrange it by men who vote and women who vote, who they vote for.
Well, it's interesting because the majority of married women voted for Trump. I'm not even talking red, blue. I'm just saying married women, the majority voted for Trump. The vast, even bigger majority of single women voted for Biden.
Why do you think that is?
Because single women are made to, women are made to have a head.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're easily deceived. And the Democrat Party knows, especially leftists know how to play the empathy card. They know how to manipulate women. And I think this is, you know, Paul even says this, you know, that, false teachers will creep into house and prey on women.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it is that all these
weak women,
all these, you know,
women without a head.
That's right. Why do you think all these lonely widows and married widows who are older are on like Home Shopping Network and are giving money to televangelists? Because they don't have leadership.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have headship, which is actually a protection. So this is the other thing that Lewis is really good about, is the men are there to lead as protectors. Like, Peter being high king isn't like, great, now woman, go make me a sandwich. That's not what that is about. The headship is for, you know, Lewis will say in other essays, male headship and rule should look like the cruciform life.
Mm-hmm. He even highlights this with Jadis and the planet that she comes from and how she made the decision to kill everyone.
I think he actually, this is the witch in the Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's Magician's Nephew is what I'm talking about.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But in, I think it's in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he refers to her as an offspring of Lilith, which is pretty interesting. I didn't catch that in previous readings of that, but that is pretty interesting. But he ties it to the fall. I think in in the Jewish myth, it's like a Talmudic myth. I think Lilith is Adam's first wife or something like this. Bad lady. Hence the witch title.
Yes. But she is the picture of the female ruler in his world.
Yes.
I mean, as well as like the green snake lady. I can't remember her name now, but yeah. So you have a couple of pictures of what about though? Let me ask you with Lucy and Susan, they're queens. What about them? Because they're ruling as yes, well, correct?
Somebody brought that up in one of the comments, but it's interesting what their rule looks like because they're not going to battle. They are definitely subservient. I mean, it's clear that Edmund and Peter are in charge. Mm-hmm. Like they're the ones making the primary decisions. Mm-hmm.
And we don't get a big part of the story where they're, you know, queens.
But. No, I think even Lucy being given like her primary gift from Father Christmas is healing. Mm-hmm. She has a dagger, but it's small and it's for self-defense. But her primary thing is healing. And even with Susan, she has the horn calling for help. Mm-hmm. It's like a rape whistle, I guess, basically.
No, it's not. It actually has a bigger theme, mentioning in
Caspian. Oh, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she's the one who calls back to the kings of old to come and
the old Narnia
or her horn. Caspian blows the horn, but they come to save the old Narnia. So yeah, there's these great themes that are tied to it. But I think it's the same instinct where people are like, oh yeah, like in the comments, people are like, oh, women aren't supposed to rule. I guess you've never heard of Esther. I'm like, that story does not prove that Esther was ruling. Mm-mm. She's a queen. Mm-hmm. But like even the way she has to approach Ashtar-Heruth or whatever his name is, however you're supposed to say that. Is like subservient and submissive as a queen must. What happened to the first queen?
She was dismissed
because she was rude to her husband.
Yeah. Well, he asked her to display her body for, you know, his nobles. So
yeah,
there was that.
There's that, but she was disobedient.
Yes, she was
to her husband. And so she, is removed. So yeah, I just think a lot of those cases where people use that, it doesn't actually prove what they think it proves. I did have one guy, by the way, in the comments, he said, there is no woman in the New Testament who is portrayed as doing anything other than obeying the Lord. And like in 2 seconds, I was like, well, Sapphira was killed for disobeying God.
That was the first one that came to mind.
Jezebel was actually a false teacher in Revelation 2:20. Like a real woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's called Jezebel, but it seems to be, you know, referring to a real person in a real place. So that's pretty interesting. So you start adding this up and you're like, there's actually a lot of faith. Herod's wife, Herod's wife's daughter. I see a lot of bad women.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah. Wow.
But that instinct, and I think that was a pastor who said that. You don't think women sin. Mm-hmm. And that's not at all what history nor the scriptures have taught us.
No, explicitly. No.
So Dan, I kind of want to wrap things up here with, why you think headship? First of all, I want to get in this broader question. There's a lot of conservatives and a lot of people in the Reformed conservative camps who are like, look, I agree with you on paper, but that's not the fight right now. And fundamentally, like if we want to win wide swaths of conservatives, we can't talk about headship. Not like that. So is it worth it to be talking about it? Simply because it's not pragmatically effective.
Yeah, I think it could possibly be the issue of our time. The number one issue of our time. I mean, obviously, like people need to repent and believe in the gospel and turn to Christ and all of that. Absolutely, yes. But the thing is, why do we as Christians allow non-Christians to be married? Because there's actually blessing in marriage. It's a picture of the gospel, though. Shouldn't that just be for Christians? It's a Christian, you know, remnant of, you know, of our society. Why is that still practiced? Why did gay people want to be married so bad? Different conversation. But the reason that we still would say it's a good thing for two unbelievers to be married instead of to live together without being married is because it's actually a blessing for them to do that. It's a blessing for society. It's covenantal
and creational.
It's covenantal and creational. And so that being said, right ordered homes are the foundation of society. I mean, read C.R. Wiley on some of this. I'm sure Zach Garris talks about it.
Any of the Westminster divines.
Exactly. When you have disordered homes, you have disordered society. It's really simple. And the thing is, institutions, you will see, I mean, we could probably all see this. If a church, as soon as a denomination or a church puts a woman on staff as an elder, it's over. It is the slide into irrelevance and to apostasy.
Even if you call her a shepherdess or a deacon.
Yeah. Or an admin, you know, type, director. A director is what the Baptists really like to do.
Just use a different title, but she's functionally leading.
Yes.
She's in a position of headship. She's exercising authority over men. And you're right. I mean, that's the end of the church and the denomination. Ecclesia Design exists to subdue the land and take dominion over it. If you're a real estate developer or a Christian seeking to transform your local landscape, Ecclesia Design offers value-aligned consultation from a family business worth supporting. Through professional land planning and landscape architecture, their master planning approach ensures your vision becomes a reality. Join us in redeeming places for the new Christendom and building Christian boroughs one identified property at a time. Go follow them on social media or visit ecclesiadesign.com today to learn more. Red meat is a staple of a healthy, protein-packed diet, but not all meat is created equal. That's why I buy my meat from Salt and Strings Butchery. Salt and Strings is owned and operated by my friends Quinn and Samantha Bible, and the meat they offer is raised, harvested, and processed exclusively in Southern Illinois. It's cut and packaged by my friends Quinn and Anthony, and not only is it the best meat I've ever had, well, all their meat is sourced from local farms that share our Christian values. Salt and Strings is now offering a beef and hog box that can be shipped directly to your door. The 15-pound beef box features 100% black Angus beef and includes ribeyes, T-bones, sirloin, chuck roast, fajita meats, and ground beef. You can order your beef box today for just $259. They will send it directly to your door. The hog box is $239 and features premium Duroc pork, including 8 thick pork chops, one of my all-time favorites, pork steaks, cured and sliced bacon, ground pork, bratwurst, and breakfast sausage links. You can place your order today at saltandstrings.com or use the link in the show notes. And also be sure to follow Salt and Strings on Instagram. We'll also include the link in the show notes. Our sponsor, Private Family Banking Partners, is on a mission to help Christians live out the Dominion mandate by making a stealth-like move away from the mainstream banks and into their own privatized banking system. This innovative system is designed to guarantee uninterrupted compound interest and tax-free growth without exposure to typical stock market risks. To join this growing community that is already building wealth into future generations and converting post-mill talk into post-mill action, contact Private Family Banking partner Chuck De Laurentiis at his email, chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. Again, that's chuck@privatefamilybanking.com. To set up an appointment and to receive a free copy of Chuck's new book, Protect Your Money Now, How to Build Multi-Generational Wealth Outside of Wall Street and Avoid the Coming Banking Meltdown, go to the link in the show notes for more information.
Yeah. Well, and so how much more society?
Well,
when you
have
households ruled by women, when you have governments ruled by women, when you have businesses ruled by women, when you have militaries ruled by women or those who dress like women, what are you going to have? The end.
So part of this is sort of, maybe it's similar to the abortion conversation, but it's like the difference between abolition and the pro-life movement. I think there's a lot of people who are adjacent to our camp who would say things like, yeah, but we're not going to win that fight today. Like, you're not going to repeal the 19th Amendment tomorrow. So we need to start with, you know, just the general gospel. Right. And so like, don't, and they'll kind of get annoyed with us. Like, can you please stop talking about like headship and like Girl Boss Inc. and, you know, lady podcasters, because conservatives aren't ready for that. And Republicans are like, we need more bright women leading out front. Da, 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 da. I've heard that for years, you know, from the political pundits. We need more pretty ladies out front. So strategically, are we being unwise by saying like, no, we think this is a big issue? Because I think what I want to say to all that is, are you ashamed of Christ's words or not? Christ, Paul, and the scriptures are just abundantly clear what happens when you put women in roles of leadership. We are doing a disservice to women, to men, to families, and all society. And so I think what you're saying is like, no, it's that important that unless you get that right, it really doesn't matter on a lot of these other points.
Well, yeah, and I think so much of our work here, not this episode in particular, but all of the body of work that we've done, what we're trying to do, and this is what the abolitionist movement misses and the pro-life movement misses, is that they don't actually paint a positive vision for the future. They don't do that. And so all you hear from is fussing, is essentially it's fussing. And so not that abolitionism is wrong. I am. Yes, absolutely. No abortion whatsoever. Criminal punishment.
And I'm sure there's like people all of that within that movement that, who, you know, some do better than others.
Yeah. Yeah. Individuals, and I'm sure.
Painting a positive
individuals,
vision.
I'm sure do that. I can think of a couple, but overall as a movement, it is the reputation known as a positive vision for the future. It's not. And I understand like the nature of abolition movement is that you're trying to stop the murdering of children. That's not the main point I'm trying to make. Why would we message the way that we do to say that one of the biggest issues, if not the biggest issue in our time, is disordered gender roles, is disordered homes, is women in leadership?
It's, well, not insignificant
because of the rest of our body of work of painting the picture for the new Christendom and the glories that are to be had when you obey Christ and you build for his glory and for the sake of your people and for your generations. It will bring blessings to your children, to your grandchildren, to the thousandth generation, Lord willing. And so that's the overarching theme. How do you actually get there to build a new Christendom? Well, you have to obey the Lord Jesus. And that begins at home.
Yeah. And this is the crazy thing. Like you look at all of Paul's, you know, the major New Testament letters, Ephesians, Romans, et cetera. When you get to household codes, where does Paul start with obedience to the gospel? Ephesians 5. It begins, you know, this is interesting. William Googe even points this out. It begins with women submitting to their husbands.
Well, and then in Paul's,
even before his address to husbands, mm-hmm. he says, wives, submit to your husbands. That's the first thing that's said about obeying the gospel. Wives, submit.
Right. And you recall in Titus 2, when Paul is telling Titus, teach younger women to be workers at home, or older women are to teach younger women to be workers at home, lest what happens? The word of God be reviled.
Yeah. So if we're in part of these like conservative, quasi conservative Christian adjacent camps, and we say, well, yeah, but this lady, I know she's out in public. I know she's ruling in her home. I know she's a politician or whatever she is. But, you know, but it's better than nobody doing it. But when you think about something like Titus 2, you're like, but this is causing the word of God to be reviled. Ultimately, yes. Isn't that what God's word says?
Pretty clear.
It's not. And this is one of the things I think with modern evangelicals, it's like, you know, what's really hard in all of this is actually that if you see what's clear in scripture and you just go, okay, I'm going to obey that. Now you have people who hate you. Now people are upset.
Well, possibly in your own home.
Yes. In your own families, right? This is where it causes problems. I want to close on a positive though, because you've been talking about positive vision.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people could listen to a podcast like this and they go, yeah, but that's not you. I hear this all the time. That was C.S. Lewis's day. Male headship doesn't work anymore. It simply doesn't work. You can't do it. Everything's feminist or egalitarian to the core. You can't actually practice. And nobody, Dan, is practicing these things today, are they? And so what I that's my question. Are they? Do you find places? Could you name a place where you actually see male headship and females submitting and being happy and marriages thriving? Do you know of such a place, Dan?
I do. Imperfectly, but... Yeah, in Ogden, Utah, we see it in our own church.
Yeah, so paint the picture for me, because do a little C.S. Lewis. Bring me into the environment. What is it like? I mean, because let me just
pull out C.S. Lewis-esque writing. I can barely get out a sentence without stumbling.
But think about this. It's like, if you place yourself in our environment, one of the things that I hear the most from outsiders, the ladies come here and they're like, I was actually a little scared about the patriarchy stuff. Like, was it going to be super judgmental, or were the other ladies going to judge me, or like, I don't dress well enough, or, you know, I don't wear enough dresses, or what if I'm not ready to head cover, whatever. They come here and the number one thing I hear is, but the women are so joyful and happy. And there's something about that that's magnetic.
Yeah.
So again.
No. So imagine with me, if you will.
I will.
You're walking east on 26th Street in Ogden, Utah. Mm-hmm. Your face is towards the mountains and the sun is rising over it. And you see the snow-capped peaks and you hear the echoes of Psalm 104 coming from a tall steepled church building that has stained glass and brick and a cornerstone dedicated to a failed church that accepted women pastors. But inside is vibrant life. And you walk through those doors and you hear the ringing echoes of My Soul, Thy Great Creator Praise, and see it filled with happy faces, joyful faces, squealing children,
sopranos
and young children, singing off key, but as loud as possible. And there are men bouncing their children in the back and, wives smiling at their husbands. And that's what Sunday is like at our church. And it is absolutely amazing. As you hear children that know the Lord's Prayer, they know the Psalms, they know Psalm 134, they know Psalm 2, they know Psalm 104, they know Psalm 98, they know all of these Psalms, Psalm 23. And you see children being taken out of the service by their fathers to the basement to be corrected for stealing their brother's snack. And women are going to back to nurse their children, and all radiating with joy. Even in the hard times, there's joy and there's fruit.
And
there's one thing that's intangible that you can't see, but you can definitely feel it. And there is a buzzing zeal and youthful excitement in the air that is contagious and makes your heart sing.
It does.
Yeah.
Wow. That was powerful, Dan. You should be a writer.
I can barely read.
I can barely read. Don't let him fool you. Yeah, that is beautiful. And I think too, even you mentioned the singing. Mm-hmm. The beauty of like a four-part singing is that when women, and they're usually soprano, right? Soprano or alto, but soprano is dominant. And then a lot of times carrying the melody or something like that. But you get into these fuguing tunes and you have the men and the basses and the tenors, but a lot of basses. That's my people over there. But you think about the way that they lead generally and how the bass part really fills the place.
It goes in first in fuguing tunes, which I think is interesting.
It is. Mm-hmm. And then the melody carried by the sopranos is this sweet, melodic accent piece. It's beautiful. It's glorious. When they're working together, they're great. You take that same female voice and you put her up front preaching and it's nothing but screeching. Mm-hmm. So, and for all of us or the bass, who's like trying to sing with a lisp. You know, the whole point is God created that order and that range, and for each, for men and women, for each sex to know their role and know their place and fit. And what you get at the end of the day, when you play your part and you play your role that God gave you, you get this beautiful hymn. Mm-hmm. And if the sopranos go stand in the bass section and be like, no, I'm a man now, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It becomes annoying.
Yeah. Yeah. Really what you're identifying is that God weaved throughout nature the harmony of the masculine and the feminine. And one of the ways that he did that was through voice.
Yes.
And so when we sing four-part psalms in harmony together, you hear the blending of these beautiful voices of the women with the men as compliments to the men. Mm. And it is absolutely gorgeous in harmony. And it's the same thing in a home. When everyone knows what their responsibilities, what their duties are, and where their roles are, you have a house that is harmonious, that is a fruitful place, and it is beautiful. Mm. But when you have a disjointed roles and duties and a lack of clarity as to what those are, you essentially have the orchestra warm up before they all hit like E or whatever.
It's like your 12-year-old when they're like playing the violin and you're like, oh, that's not pleasant.
And it does result in pain and actually death.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really helpful, Dan. I appreciate that. Appreciate this conversation. By the way, come join us June 6th through 8th in Ogden, Utah. If you want to hear some of that singing, there's going to be a packed house. One of the other things we want to let you know, we'll be at Ogden High School, very beautiful building. You can catch some of the Instagram reels that are up about that to see what that building looks like on, you know, my Eric on my Instagram or on Brian Sauvé's, a bunch of pictures and stuff like that. It's going to be a beautiful venue. We're going to have at least 650 people because that's what we got today. And there's going to be more, Dan, but there's going to be glorious singing.
Oh, Sunday is going to be great because our whole church is going to be here.
Well, that's what I want to encourage people to. One of the things that we need to talk more about is that we will have Ogden High School for Sunday service. So we won't be in the church building so that we can accommodate everybody who's here and in town. So we want to encourage you.
Like four services.
So. Yeah, that it just wouldn't work. So if you're in town, please stay. We'd love to have you for worship on Sunday. In Ogden, Utah, I guess that'll be the 9th.
The 9th.
June 9th. Come and join us. Go to the link in the show notes or go to newchristendompress.com/conference to sign up for that conference. We look forward to seeing you guys there. Once again, Dan, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. Headship is great. We love it. And C.S. Lewis, Narnia. Game changer. Game changer. Dan, do you remember our closing? Did I put you on the spot one more time?
Stay frosty, fight the good fight, and act like men.
Let's go.